Welcome back, friends and readers, to the Book Exchange podcast. We are back with a show after a long hiatus. This is episode 53 of the Book Exchange podcast. We're calling it The Return / What We've Been Reading. For listeners who are familiar with the show format, we always have a What We've Been Reading segment where we talk about exactly that. You know, what books we have been we've been going through and anything we want to highlight. Well, the show's been away for 9 months, folks, so we decided we would dedicate this episode to just covering some of our favorite books that we've read in the time we've been away. So sort of by nature and by design, this is going to be a loose episode. We thought, you know, we're getting our sea legs back as my co-host, who I should introduce, by the way. Sorry about that. This is John Lovell. I'm speaking from Maryland. I am one half of your Book Exchange podcast host, cadre. My co-host here is Jude Joseph Lovell. He's speaking from Pennsylvania. Jude, welcome back to the show.
Yeah. I'm glad to be back. This is going to be great. I mean, thank you for all of you who are tuning in. Good to be here.
Indeed. So, yeah, we think this is going to be just a loose kind of, like I was calling it, off air, so to speak. I was calling it sort of a hangout episode. And it's something we may occasionally do as we get back, as we get the show back up and running, and just kind of talk about whatever we want to talk about related to books and reading and stuff we've been reading, and just share recommendations, not only with each other, but with you, the listeners. Now, if you happen to be new to this podcast has been going for a couple of years. It's called the Book Exchange Podcast. And the kind of unique angle or take that we have is we are two identical twin brothers who have been reading just about our entire lives. Funnily enough, Jude, like I realize this is episode 53, which happens to be more or less the age that we are. We'll be turning 53 a little bit later in the year. So that's kind of a funny coincidence, but, you know, it feels right.
Yeah, karma.
Yeah, that's right. So, Jude and I have been lifelong avid readers, and we've always been close friends as twin brothers, which is not necessarily a given, but it's certainly true for us. And we've shared thoughts and recommendations and musings about books basically since we could read. And we both started reading at a pretty early age. So this has been going on for 50 years, basically. And the idea was to sort of take that 50-year conversation and turn it into a show. We came up with this idea as a lot of podcasts began, you know, at the beginning of the pandemic. And we just thought it would be an enjoyable way to spend time while we were all cooped up in our houses. Well, it's 2 years later. We went on for about 2 years. We had a run of 52 shows. And we built up a solid listenership that's international, people listening from other countries and such. So, and we're very grateful for anybody who takes the time to, you know, tune in and listen. So that's just a little bit about this show. Then we hit some technical snags and, you know, had some personal things going on. Jude and I both have, you know, fairly large families, so there's a lot going on. Eventually we figured out a way to use a new podcast app. And so we're trying this new app today. We're trying to get the show back up and running. And so I'll just issue this disclaimer. It's a brand new app for both of us. We're still figuring out how it works. You know, we're both family men and working guys. We don't have dedicated podcasting studios. We don't have corporate sponsorship. You know, we don't have a mammoth advertising budget. We've got none of that. This is entirely DIY. So this recording and other recordings coming up in the future, they may be raw, they may be unpolished, but we're hopeful that the content, for those of you who are interested, the content will make up for whatever is lacking in production value. So those are kind of, that's a little bit of the background. Those are the disclaimers. I'll pass it over to you, Jude, but you can give your own comments on this, but I got to say, I'm really excited to be back. There's so much to talk about in the world of books. You know, this is a show where if I can say this about this show, if nothing else, we read very widely and broadly. We cover just about any genre you can think of, and that's sort of a point of pride for us. You're not going to get the same show twice. And I would venture to say, you're going to get kind of deeper cuts and recommendations on this show than you might on your average book or reading podcast. You know, we go all over the place, and I've really been missing this in this conversation with you and the listeners. And I'm so glad that we're back going again, and let's get it on, as Marvin Gaye said. So what do you have to say, Jude? I'm sure you're excited about coming back as well.
Oh, yeah, I'm really excited. You know, I think you did a nice job of setting it up there. We don't even know if the one we're recording at this very moment is going to work the way we want it to. You know, so we'll find out, like, what John – but John set it up correctly, you know, as far as the recent history goes and as far as this new part of the endeavor. We're 100% fueled and funded by, I'm going to use a term that John, you like to use. This is all like 100% funded and fueled by pure nerdery, you know, between the two twins. But yeah, that's exactly what it is. That's a, like our whole angle, as you explained well, and as we said briefly in the, if anyone heard the teaser, you know, that said that we were coming back, is that it's just, again, it's a conversation that's very organic for us because it's just, it's been going on the whole time, you know, like we've, you know, there have been little glitches, but basically our whole lives we've been talking about books and reading, you know, in some way, you know, and certainly for the last, you know, 30, 35 years or so. So like, you know, and it's not slowing down. So like the whole concept here is just to have that conversation sort of in a more broad forum and dork out about books and reading and writing and literature. And that's exactly what we're here to do. So, yeah, but I'm really excited to be back. It was really, like I started to say in the teaser, it was really kind of more of a lifeline for both of us than we even fully expected, I think, you know, for different reasons, right. You know, as everybody tried to manage the stress of the pandemic and all that stuff. And, you know, there were other things that were going on with us that, you know, don't necessarily need to be explained on the air, but there were some pretty significant things happening between both of us and our families. And one of the ways we've always kind of navigated them is to kind of almost like, you know, you don't push anything aside that's important, but you sort of shove it aside for a few minutes when you talk about books and reading, at least we do, and dork out. And it helps us, it helps to ground us is what I'm saying. So what all you're hearing is kind of what we've always done.
Yeah. And the show kind of exists in part to celebrate that. In fact, we've had this tradition that we,
yeah, good point. That's well said.
Yeah. We've had this tradition between us that we literally call the book exchange. One of the reasons why we don't have the E on that book, on that word exchange, by the way, is that we both attended Xavier University. So X is a huge letter for us. So, exchange with an X. But we've kind of, that's sort of our nickname for our, not only this conversation, but, you know, every year for birthdays, for Christmas, for other occasions, we exchange books. So the show is just an extension of our lives and that conversation, as we've been saying. If you're brand new to the show, I would encourage you, go back and look at the, you know, previous 52 episodes to get a sense for where this show goes. I mean, we tend to have theme shows a lot. So we've done an episode on poetry. We've done an episode on Western themed literature. We've done all kinds of episodes. So I encourage you to scroll through the list. We also do, occasionally we'll do deep dives into a particular writer. We did one on a writer named Jim Shepherd. We did one on the well-known short story writer and novelist T.C. Boyle. We did one on Ernest Hemingway. So there are many of those. And then there's also episodes that we've done that just dive into a particular book that are kind of spoiler filled. And, you know, it might be a book that we really want to, you know, pick apart. So we do all of that. And as I mentioned before, I think we're also going to make it kind of an ongoing occasional series to do something like what we're doing today, which is what I called sort of a hangout episode and just talk, not have too much of a structure, but talk about books we've been reading lately. And we thought that would be a nice way to kind of segue back into the show. You know, it's been a 9-month period. We've both done a lot of reading in that period. So we've got a lot to talk about in terms of books we want to, you know, recommend to each other and to the listeners. Last thing by way of introduction I'll say is, you know, we're open to your suggestions and feedback for the show. We've got an email address. It's bookexchangetwins, that's B-O-O-K-X-change, twins, all one word, at gmail.com. We'd love to hear your feedback, your comments, your criticisms, and especially if you have an idea for the show or something that you'd like us to cover, we're wide open to that because this is a loose formatted show, and it's for anyone who loves reading and also considers himself to be an adventurous reader. If you're that kind of a reader, I think you've found a home here with your Book Exchange Twins. So, dude, unless I miss anything, I think that's a good introduction, and then we can kind of, the way this show works is we usually talk about, you know, what we're reading now, and then we kind of get into the main meat of the topic that we're here to discuss, and towards the end we'll talk about, you know, anything we're planning on reading and kind of tease the next show. So, is there anything that I missed in this long-winded introduction?
Nope, I don't think so. I think we're ready to roll. Yeah, let's keep it going.
Let's keep it rolling. Jude, what is on your reading table right now? What have you been reading? What are you excited about or maybe not excited about? What's going on?
Well, if anybody's new to the show, I don't want you to get the wrong impression, okay? But at the moment, I'm reading a book that's actually, it's weirdly quite fun to read. I'll try to explain why. The book I'm reading right now is a novel that came out in the early 90s. It is the novel. I've always wanted to read this book. I won't tease it too much, but I've always wanted to read this book because I was interested in the way I got to, I knew about this book, but the way, because it's very famous, or maybe notorious is a better word, or infamous. But the way I got to know about it, at least what the story is the way a lot of people did, which is the movie that came out in the year 2000, I believe. And it's the movie that really, it wasn't the first movie for this actor, but it really put Christian Bale on the map. The book is called American Psycho. And it's by a writer named Bret Easton Ellis. And it came out in the early 90s, but it's definitely set in New York City, right in the heart of the 80s. And if anybody doesn't know about American Psycho, it's this book about 20-somethings in the 80s that work on Wall Street, you know, and are very vapid and, you know, rich, way ahead of their maturity. And they've got money to burn and, you know, almost nothing driving them from a moral point of view except for just more excess. And it happens to feature this famous character named Patrick Bateman, who's kind of moves in these circles, but also happens to be like a brutal serial killer at night. You know, and the book was very divisive when it was published. And I went back and I was actually looking over some of the reviews. I'm only about a third of the way into it, but it's interesting to read because I remember kind of the splash that it made, but I didn't really, you know, read the reviews at the time or anything like that. But it's funny how far and wide the reviews of this book kind of range, John. Like, you know, there are some reviews. So the book is old enough that it was reviewed famously, for example, by Norman Mailer, who's been dead for many years.
Wow.
In Vanity Fair. And he was like, you know, the reviews were totally, you know, at opposite ends of the spectrum. Norman Mailer said, this is the first novel I've read in a long time that was like, that shares themes with like Dostoevsky, where it's like a really important book. You know, and a lot of the reviews said it was very important and kind of like a seminal novel. But all the way on the other end, there's a famous reviewer named Jonathan Yardley, Washington Post. You've heard of him, right, John?
Oh, yeah.
And he called the book in the headline and throughout the review as just unadulterated trash. Mm-hmm. You know, because the book contains heavy amounts of not only violence and brutality, especially against young women, but also it contains a lot of pornography. And pornographic description. So it has brutal violence and like pornography in it. And it's very like, you know, it's very excessive, which is part of the point.
Yeah.
So anyway, I find it very interesting to be reading. It is gross. I won't go off on it for too long. It's gross. It's violent. It's got tons of sex in it. It's got, you know, both straight and homosexual like overtones or scenes. You know, it's got everything you want. It's a book you got to time to take a shower after every time you sit down to read it for a little while. But it's also, you know, obviously about American excess and like capitalism and sort of pointedly has all these things because the writer is sort of arguing that this is kind of like we're reaping what we've sown, you know, in this particular period, for being such a rich and sort of like excessive and capitalistic driven society, you know. So you're where you fall down on it is up to you. For me, I said I was having fun reading it, which is, you know, which is, you know, I don't know if that's the right word, but it so happens, John, the one thing that I was going to point out to you in reading it, and then I'll just stop there, is that, you know, because of our age, so we were born in 1970, you know, and we were growing up in the 80s, so we were like teenagers when all this was happening. But, and the book is famous for being overstuffed with references to like clothing and stereo technology and music and all these things from the 1980s. Every single paragraph in this book is filled with these like brand names and like, you know, cultural hot points that you and I sort of grew up on. And it's unbelievable how much of that is in this book, especially the book version. So you're reading it and you're like, you know, like every brand name and every music reference and every CD and every nightclub and every restaurant, all that kind of stuff. I was never very good with fashion, you know, so I don't know all the clothing brands as well. There's certainly tons of that in the book, but it's all kind of nostalgic for us. And then it has to be said, the other weird thing is one of the big side characters, sort of heroic figures behind this book, is Donald Trump, you know, who ended up becoming the president of the United States, which only sort of proves the point,
right?
You know, in a weird way, of where this guy was going. So you can definitely see this as a very prescient book. I mean, Donald Trump was like literally the patron saint behind this guy, Patrick Bateman. And the fact that he ended up becoming the 45th president is just bananas.
Totally.
You know?
Yeah.
Totally bananas. So like reading it now is like just even more insane. And it makes Bret Easton Ellis seem like some kind of prophet, you know? But anyway, I'll leave it there. The movie version, you know, I'm a fan of the movie in some ways, but it's, you know, it's a tough watch. And, you know, everybody sort of knows about this story, but that's what I'm reading. And, you know, it'd be, I don't know what you would make of it. But anyway, over to you. Why don't you take us into safer waters or something?
Well, it's funny you say that, because what I'm going to talk about, what I'm reading right now, it could not be further away on the spectrum from what you just described.
But, well, there you go.
It's funny.
That's the show, folks.
You know, you and I grew up in the shadow of New York City. We grew up in northern New Jersey. And so I've explained when Donald Trump was elected, and this is not a political show at all, although I don't mind not hiding my, you know, disdain for him as a candidate and a president. But when he was elected, I remember explaining to my kids, like, or saying to my kids, you guys just have no idea. Like, he is like a shadowy figure kind of throughout our whole lives, especially in that period you're talking about, the 80s. If you live near New York City, he was constantly in the news, especially the gossip rags, you know, just known as this wheeler dealer, you know, the epitome of like materialism and get rich now and, you know, capitalism run amok and kind of everything that's sort of disgusting really about capitalism and, you know, making money. And he was just this prominent figure then. And so I was trying to convey to them my utter incredulity over the fact that he was elected president of these United States. So, you know, I could see how that book would be weirdly prophetic and also kind of certainly, I don't know if nostalgic is the right word, but maybe it is. Just reminded you of that period, especially in and around New York City. I never read the book, but I do. Everybody who knows anything about the movie knows about the monologue about Huey Lewis in the news.
Yeah.
Is that in the book? It's got to be.
Well, I haven't gotten that far yet, but there's been mention of Huey Lewis, and I think there's some of it is really faithful to the – some of the movie is really faithful to the book, so we'll see. I'm not sure if in that particular scene is going to go exactly the way the book is, but, you know, he's already been mentioned a few times, so.
Well – you know, we're already running long here, which is like, I don't know if you remember the Muppet movie where they make a joke about the running gag that runs through the whole movie and there's like 10 of them. But, you know, that, and I'm dating myself with that reference too, because I think that's like 1981 or something.
Nah, even further back, yeah.
Is it 79 or something like that? Great movie though. But it's a running gag on this show, this whole thing. Well, we're running a little bit long because that's kind of what we do. But we frankly don't care because we enjoy so much hanging out and talking about books.
Yeah, but who cares?
In terms of we care about the listeners, but, you know, if you're into this kind of stuff, hopefully you pick up on the enthusiasm. What I am reading, as I mentioned, could not be any further, any more different from what you're reading. And there is a poet that I'm a poetry, big poetry fan. You're a fan to some degree, but not to the same degree that I am. One of my favorite poets of all time is a Welsh-English poet named R.S. Thomas, who's actually also happened to be a priest. And I know I talked about it. If you go back into our show archive, we had an entire episode about poetry called Reverse. Not too far back in the list, but far back in terms of, you know, the mists of our own minds. We did that, right. I think it was episode 50 or 51. And I'm sure I talked about R.S. Thomas there. There was also another episode we did further back around Thanksgiving one year that was called Writers We're Thankful For. I might have mentioned R.S. Thomas in that episode too, though I don't remember. But R.S. Thomas is an amazing poet. You know, among my many interests as a reader are books about spirituality and faith, and also books about nature and the natural world. And R.S. Thomas is a particularly insightful and poignant poet around both of those themes. So he's one of my favorite poets. He's written some incredible stuff. I wish we had time to just get into all of it, but we don't. But so I got interested in him, you know, maybe 20 years ago. And he's not super well known now. But I think he died in the mid-90s. And I really just got hooked by his poetry. But you know, if I get really hooked by a writer, I want to kind of learn everything I can about them. So I got interested in him and his life and his work. I believe you gave me a biography that was written about him. The title of the skate, something like The Man Who Went Into the West, I think is the title. And it's a fascinating look at his life story. He spent most of his life just as a pastor of rural parishes in Wales. So basically he was ministering to farmers and shepherds, very rural, very simple. And he just spent most of his life doing that and, you know, soaking in the nature, the rugged nature of Wales.
And John,
yeah.
He was an Anglican priest. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. Not Roman Catholic.
Okay. Yeah, because he was married?
Yeah, he was married. Yep.
Gotcha. Right, go ahead. Sorry.
Because Jude and I are from a Catholic background, but, you know, it's very close. Anyway, in my reading about R.S. Thomas, I learned somewhere along the way that he had written an autobiography, but it was only published in Welsh. And the name of the autobiography, I won't even attempt to say the Welsh title, but it translates to No One. That's the name of his autobiography, No One, which is really interesting. So I had heard about the existence of that, and I had never seen it in English. And then I just happened to recently, you know, kind of stumble across, I guess at some point in the late 90s or around 2000, a number of his autobiographical writings were published in English. It wasn't, not in this country, but over in England. So I found out, basically I learned that you can get an English version translation of No One, and plus three other writings of his, which are called Former Paths, The Creative Writer's Suicide, and A Year in Lyn. I don't know how to say it, L-L-Y-N. So I was basically over the moon. I was thrilled because I'd always wanted to read his own take on his own life, but it was only available in Welsh. And I finally, so I was saying to Jude off air, that to me, this was like the white whale or one of the white whales in my, you know, we all have these books that we maybe wish we could get a hold of, but can't for whatever reason. Finally got a hold of it and I'm reading it now. And it's as satisfying as I would have hoped it would have been. It just, if you're interested in his poetry at all, it just fills in a lot of the background and gives you his perspective on what it was like to minister to basically peasant people and farmers in Wales and how the landscape affected him. And it just really fleshes out a lot that I know is going to help me understand his poetry even more. And it's just a fascinating, beautifully written book. I'm really, really enjoying it. So that's that. I'll leave it there. That's what I'm reading now. R.S. Thomas Autobiographies. And I'm thrilled about it. It's fantastic.
Yeah. You found that in a store, John?
I found it online. I was looking for something else and I saw it. I said, no way. I can't. I thought this wasn't available in English. And it was like $12. I had to get it from the UK, but it was not super expensive. And I was just thrilled.
Yeah, that was like truly an Ahab kind of moment there for you.
It was for me. Yep.
Yeah, that's really cool. I you're right. I'm what you said before is accurate. Like as listeners to the show know, I'm nowhere near the poetry fan that John is, but like that R.S. Thomas is one of the ones we talked about it in reverse. The I think it was episode 50. You're right. That's one of the ones that John kind of was successful in getting me to at least read one of their books, and then we sort of bonded over that a little bit. Like, and we talked about it in that episode, like, cause his poetry is like really impressive and really, to me, like accessible, like it's not too obscure, like you can't figure out what the heck they're talking about, which is like,
right.
Part of the, problem and or, I don't know what the word is I want, but like the good part of poetry, depending on where you're coming from. So like, yeah. So I was excited when I heard you found that and I can't say I'm surprised that it's like turning out to be what you hoped it was,
Yeah, I wish I had time to read. I picked out a couple of short passages that give you a sense of how beautifully written it is and sort of what the atmosphere and landscape is like that he's writing about. But I'm not going to take the time to do that. His poetry is amazing. Anybody who has any interest at all in poetry, particularly the intersection of, the natural world poetry and the world of the spirit, R.S. Thomas is somebody you definitely need to read. So, and he has many books. He was nominated for the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1996. This guy is a real heavy hitter as far as I'm concerned. So that's.
Yeah, and he's not, it ain't all hearts and flowers either. Like, he's a very, like, realistic and sometimes dark poet,
Oh, for sure. And he acknowledges that in this book. He talks very openly about. The word he uses is bitterness. And he says, there's a lot of bitterness that creeps into my poetry, especially in the early years, but it reflects a lot of the, the political situation in Wales, the loss of the Welsh language, the kind of, taking over of the Welsh culture by the British culture, et cetera. So, he's very self-aware. He knows that element is there, but my favorite element from him, from my personal perspective is how he's a man of faith, but he grapples very openly with God and his faith and with religion in general in his poems. And I can really relate to that as most of us probably can. So, I just find him very human, but incredibly insightful as well. There's a lot of wisdom in his work. So,
yeah, no doubt about that.
We just talked about what we're reading right now. What we're going to do now is talk about, during the hiatus, we're going to talk about some of the best books that we read or some books that we read that we want to recommend to listeners and just kind of have a loose conversation about that. There are many books that we've read across those 9 months, but we each wanted to pick a few and just kind of recommend them. So I think we should just dive right into it unless you want to take a short break.
I'm okay for now. We might take one a little later, but I'm okay right now. Yeah, let's just keep going.
All right, let's dive into it. And we've both made what I might do. This is where we really start to wing it. I decided I might just do a really quick speed round and just mention some of my favorite books that I read towards the end of last year. But I'm not going to talk about them really. I'm just going to mention them. And then I have three books that I wanted to highlight that I've read in that during that period that I think are worth noting. That's how I'm going to approach it. How are you going to approach it?
I'm just going to, so I don't have my list with me or anything like that. So I don't necessarily have that with me, although I don't care how we do it. We can do it any way we want. I've got three kind of books or slash one is two books, but three selections I'm going to talk about just that for me were the biggest standouts from the period when we stopped in like the middle of the summer to now. So if you want to hit some like first that you read towards the end of last year and just highlight those, go ahead.
Yeah, I'll try to do that really quickly. You know, we both keep a running list of the books we read throughout the year. I mean, there's so many good ones. I did want to point out some of my favorites. The first thing I wanted to point out, though, and this hasn't come up in the show, but you probably knew it was coming, Jude, is that I forgot to mention before that both Jude and I do writing professionally for our jobs. So we're not just coming at this podcast from the perspective of being readers. We're also writers. But Jude is a published writer who's written many books. He is a much more experienced writer, especially when I don't write any fiction, but Jude does. He writes quite a lot of fiction. He's now published. How many books have you written now? Is it 14?
Yeah, I guess it's 14. Yeah, 14 or 15. 14 books. I think it's 14 published, and there was one that was not published.
So the reason I bring that up was, number one, to say that this is, you know, I think you'll hear reflected on this show that we have an interest in the craft of writing as well as reading. But I did read two of Jude's books in the time that we've been away. He's actually put out two of them since we've been off air, so to speak. And I just wanted to mention them. The first was a collection of short stories. I believe it's your fourth collection of short stories. I think there's one that, I don't know, fourth or fifth.
Yeah, it's fourth. Yeah.
Okay, fourth. It's called All Men Are Brothers. I do want to highly recommend it. You can get it on Amazon if you search for Jude Joseph Lovell, but it's a really fun and diverse collection. That's one thing, you know, Jude writes in the way that we both read, and he really kind of stretches himself, tries to go deliberately so, especially with the short stories, try to go in all kinds of different directions. One of the writers that he emulates in that is T.C. Boyle, who was mentioned before, who also does the same thing. But in this volume, there's a World War II story. There's kind of like a James Bond, Jason Bourne sort of action set piece kind of story. It's a lot of fun. There's a story where he literally embodies the singer from Motorhead, Lemmy, and lets you live literally in his body for a couple of days. That's a pretty wild ride. And there's a very unique and you know, kind of beautiful take on the Christmas story and the night of the birth of Christ. So it's a really fun collection. I wanted to mention that. I highly recommend it. And then I just read another book that he's put out more recently, which is kind of a personal memoir that he wrote that centers around the game of baseball. And he's sort of, after many decades away from the game, he kind of found himself back to it. And it's kind of a meditation on what it is about baseball that has drawn him back in and what it means to be a baseball fan. And it works in some, you know, autobiographical stuff. A lot of memories from childhood. But if you're a baseball fan and you know others or are interested in baseball at all, that's a fun and kind of loose and engaging read. That's called The Tie Goes to the Runner. And that too can be found on Amazon. So those are two fun books I read. Recommend that you check those out if you can.
Thank you for saying that.
Yeah, absolutely. The other book, I want to talk about another book that was a really fun read during the hiatus, and that's a book that Jude actually gave me. It's called Frankenstein in Baghdad. It's by an Iraqi writer, Ahmed Sadawi. And I'm not sure he has too many other books other than this one, which came out maybe 10 years ago or 7 or 8 years ago. But it's a fascinating kind of retelling of the Frankenstein story, but it's set in Iraq during the war in the early 2000s. Yeah. Can you still hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. Got a little bit of an echo there. But that was a really fun and kind of interesting, you know, updating of that story. And very, very unique and kind of dark, but it was one of the most interesting books that I read during the hiatus. The other one that I just wanted to mention really quickly, dude, and you're going to love this because I know you're a huge fan, but I was absolutely shocked at what a profound and deep book the memoir from Nick Cave, the musician Nick Cave, was, called Faith, Faith, Hope, and Carnage. It's kind of a collection of interviews that he did with an Irish journalist. But this book goes really deep into the not only human grief and the process of grieving, because Nick Cave has lost two sons. It goes really deep into the craft of songwriting and creating music. And there's a lot in it about God and religion. And I was just shy. I'm a fan of Nick Cave's. Jude is not. That's why I brought this up, because I knew we would love this part. But I was deeply shocked at how deep and penetrating these conversations were, and his thoughts about, particularly about human suffering and grief and how it relates to God and religion, is a very, very, one of the most interesting books from a musician that I've ever read. So I wanted to mention that one too. So those are just a couple, and I'll get back to a couple more later. But I'm going to pass it over to you. What's the first book that you wanted to highlight, unless you wanted to comment on anything?
Well, I mean, good list. Number one, those are all interesting choices. You know, I never read Frankenstein of Baghdad, but it just, you know, it stood out to me as something that might be interesting. So I'm glad that that worked out for you. Of course, I appreciate very much you bringing up my books. Didn't know you were going to do that. So I appreciate that. And I have to say, by the way, people, you know, John read my most recent book, which is The Tigos, The Runner. And John could care less about baseball. You know, like, John, he does not have time for baseball. He read it because he's a, you know, he's a fan of my books, of course, and a supporter of me. Hopefully he got something out of it, but that was really, you know, that was a stretch for him to even pick it up and read it. So I greatly appreciate that.
Yeah, it was, it was fun, and it's kind of like lighthearted, which is cool.
Yeah, it's certainly meant to be kind of a light, L-I-T-E, but not in a bad way. An easy read. It's supposed to be unburdensome. It's supposed to be fun, and that's the way I tried to create that book. And then it's true, I can't stand Nick Cave's music. I don't know what it is. Like, you know, when he comes out, I am out. But I know John is a big fan, and I certainly, you know, have admiration for his career and what he's been through. And, you know, it's hard for me to imagine what he's been through. And look, when you find, you know, I just read a book by Bono. I'm not going to talk about it much, but like when you find a musician's memoir that's like actually really interesting and you're a really big fan of their music, it can be a very satisfying journey. You know, if they know what they're doing. Yeah. So that's cool. But, so for me, like the first I wanted to mention is actually two books. Don't have to go on it at length, but this is like, I wanted to bring up this particular writer who I discovered this year. I read both of these books in the first, you know, half of the year here. And the writer is an Irish woman whose name is Claire Keegan. And I really wanted to bring up these two books by her that I read because I was very impressed by them, which I'll try to explain in sort of a small way. So I didn't know anything about her. She's kind of a contemporary fiction writer with quite a reputation. I know now she has, I think, two collections of short stories. I don't even remember what they're called. One of them, I think, is called Antarctica or the Arctic, I think. And the other one is something else. I'm sure she's a good story writer. I haven't really read her short fiction before. She just kind of came on to the scene here in America, and I kept sort of running into her name. And she published two like really short novels in like, you know, hardbound, like single book format, although they could have been combined with other things. And the first book I read is short now. It's about 120 pages. It's called Small Things Like These. And then the second one is even shorter than that. It's only about 90 pages. I believe it was originally like a kind of a novella or a longer story, but they published it as its own little hardcover book here, like they do sometimes in the United States. And that book was called Foster. And it was also recently turned into a film with a different name called The Quiet Girl, like an independent Irish film, which is supposed to be very good. I haven't seen it yet. But it's supposed to be kind of almost a discovery of this young girl who's in the main character of the book Foster is a little girl who gets kind of taken in into like a foster home or like a, you know, another with another set of parents. And she's 9 years old and just going through a lot of stuff. And so they must have found a promising young actress to play her. And the whole thing would have hinged on how good of an actor this young girl is, you know. So it'd be interesting. And I heard that this, whoever the girl was, they found for the movie The Quiet Girl really, really pulls it off. But I'm going to try to explain why I was so impressed and kind of moved by both of these books, you know, because they're really short. They're very, very simple. The writing is very simple. Both books are kind of sad and a little bit dark and a little bit gloomy, kind of like the best of, you know, Irish art and culture, right? But they're both really impressive. Like, I was really moved by both of them, and it's just about how simple they are and how, like, they're very basic stories. Like, the book Small Things Like These is just about this guy who was sort of born to a mother in Ireland, you know, in the mid-20th century, out of wedlock, which is, of course, like a big no-no. And he was, instead of, like, being of her, his mother being kind of, like, cast out, she was taken in by a very, of course, the mother was Catholic and sort of destitute. She had this young son, and it was, and she was very, you know, persona non grata, right? But she happened to cross paths with an older woman who was Protestant, who took pity on her and took her in so she could raise her son. But the story is about the son who has kind of a solid, good marriage, and he has these five young daughters that he's raising in modern Ireland. Wow. And he is also coming under very hard economic times, and he's trying to raise these girls who have like a variety of like different personalities and issues. And that's kind of the whole story, you know? And it's just this poignant tale about this guy and how he navigates through kind of the Christmas season during 1 year and the little struggles he has with each individual girl as they're kind of growing up. And then as the novel slowly unfolds, it's very subtle and painstaking, but you start to learn further revelations about who this guy's father was, you know, who he didn't know who he was his entire life. And then it sort of comes out who his father is, and it's just beautifully written. And when I was reading it, it was moving, but I was so impressed by the artistry of the writing. And I thought, man, this book doesn't miss a step throughout. And the fact that it's condensed to 120 pages to me is just mind blowing, because I just don't know how anybody packs that much into such a small space. And then I moved on to Foster, which is about similar themes, but there's a family that has too many children and they can't afford them in Ireland. So they decide, you know, really not by choice. The father's kind of a drunk. And so they make this difficult decision to give their oldest child for a while on a temporary basis to a childless couple in Ireland who take her in at age 9. She's extremely quiet. She's very kind of fragile. They don't know how to deal with her. And the story is about them slowly, slowly connecting with this little girl. And of course, other details slowly emerge in the same kind of fashion about the family that she came from and also the parents that are fostering her, you know, and you find out that they've been through a particular loss that's been very damaging for them. And the book kind of, you know, follows this period of time when they're all living together and just sort of drawing closer to one another. Both books are unbelievable in terms of how well they're written, and they're very moving. And I thought that the writer just did not miss a step the entire way in both of those. And I was like, man, I'm a fan for life of this woman, Claire Keegan. So I was very impressed by them, and I wanted to recommend them to anybody who likes Irish literature, contemporary literature, and who's okay with books that are kind of sad, you know? So I'll leave it there.
Yeah. I gotta say I knew that you were reading her, and I hadn't heard of her before, but I didn't know anything about really either book. But to hear you describe them, they sound very, very good. I gotta say, both of those books sound really interesting. You know, in particular, you know, the first one you were talking about, you were describing, you know, here's a, you know, a father who's got multiple children and he's dealing with various issues with each of them, and he's trying to navigate how difficult that is and also just keep afloat financially and all that stuff. And I thought, nothing that either you or I can relate to in that description at all, you know, like, right.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just like, there's so much there that we could relate to, just being, we both have multiple children, you know, they're a little bit older, just trying to deal with, you know, all the issues that come up, and each one is so unique, and their problems and their struggles are unique. I mean, I'm dealing with a lot of that stuff right now, as I know you are. So I'm sure that was pretty poignant.
Yeah.
And then combine that with just poetic writing. I mean, that sounds like that's the kind of reading that is great for fiction and for the mind, but also the heart.
Yeah. I think you would really like them, John. I forgot to say one thing I can cover quickly. They're not sparing. So these are written by an Irish woman, and they do go into the plight of women in particular in Ireland, and especially there are some of the common villains in stories like this. There's a, particularly in small things like these, there's a convent that raises girls that doesn't get spared the writer's vision. But I thought, though, I would argue that she wrote these books in such a way that reflected some of whatever her anger over the situation, the plight of women are in Ireland, and some of the abuses that they've been through. I would not, you and I are Catholic, and sometimes, you know, in an Irish story, the Catholic people are like the villains, and it's pretty, you know, common for that to happen. I thought this writer made some of her points in a way that was not over the top and was also very, very hard not to consider where women in particular during this period of time in Ireland are coming from. I thought she handled that nicely, but it's not sparing. It's very, you know, there's some anger there, but it's just done in such a way that you really think about it. I'll say it that way.
Well, those both sound like really worthwhile reads, and that sounds like a writer that's definitely worth taking notice of. So that's a great one. Cool. Well, we're going to keep moving on here. The first book I would like to talk about, or really highlight, because it's one of the most interesting books I've read in a long time. I've for my three selections that I wanted to talk about a little bit more, I have two of them are nonfiction and one is fiction. Anybody who's listened to this show knows that sometimes, you know, Jude is, we both read widely, but if it's 60-40 in the favor of fiction for Jude, it's 60-40 in the favor of nonfiction for me. So you kind of
get
sort of a nice mix. This is a book that made a big splash last year. It's a science book. I particularly love reading about science and the natural world. And I mentioned that with my little comments on poetry, but there's something about reading about nature and biology and animals. I don't know what it is. It really, I'm just fascinated by it. And the older I get, the more I like to read about it. So this is a book about that. It is about animal science and is written by a biologist turned journalist named Ed Yong. He's a guy who gained a lot of attention for writing a book. His first book was called I Contain Multitudes, and it was all about microbes, specifically microbes in the human body and kind of their fascinating functions and, you know, what they're there for and all the incredible things that they're responsible for or that they do. And that sounded like an amazing book that I had heard about but never read. This book is called An Immense World, How Animal Senses Reveal the Hidden Realms Around Us. And it takes the very ambitious topic of trying to describe, you know, look at the sensory world of animals in general and basically make the point that there's so much more going on this planet that we are totally unaware of because of our limitations as human beings. But the world around us is indeed immense in terms of what's going on that we have no clue about. The title, An Immense World, comes from a quote from William Blake that is at the very beginning of the book, the poet William Blake. And it's this, and I read it because it's kind of, it's almost an encapsulation of the entire book. And it says, how do you know but every bird that cuts the airy way is an immense world of delight closed by your senses five? So making the point that basically that there's so much going on with other animals and other species around us that we can't access because of our own limitations, our own limited sensory world. And this is just a broad-ranging and fascinating look at all kinds of different animals and the world that they live in. There's a key concept in this book that's called Umwelt, which is a concept that was coined by a 19th century semiotician and philosopher named Jacob von Uexküll. I'm sure I'm butchering that. But basically what it means is the world that is experienced, the world as it is experienced by a particular organism, what their senses allow them to perceive. So, you know, for example, a bat navigates and moves around the world through echolocation. So the way that they take in the world around them is totally different than the way a human being does. Or, you know, dogs navigate and they kind of, so much of their experience is guided by their sense of smell. And he goes into great detail for many, many different animals about, you know, kind of, you know, tapped into the most cutting edge science about what they may be experiencing. And it does, it gives you this, by the time it's a dense book, it's thick. By the time you get to the end of it, you go, man, it really is an immense world. There's so much going on around us in the trees, in the air, with the insects of the ground, and of course, all the animals in the ocean that we just have absolutely no idea about. It's a bit like reading about alien civilizations. It really is.
yeah.
And it's just, I mean, it's just fascinating. It goes widely into, you know, elephants and insects and electricity and certain types of sea creatures and how that's used. You know, what does a dog pick up when it smells? When a dog is smelling on a fire hydrant, it's not just smelling that another dog peed there. It can tell if it was male or female. It can tell what kind of breed it was. It can tell if a dog was pregnant. It's just stuff like that. You know, a dolphin knows. There have been documented cases where a dolphin knows that a woman is pregnant before the woman does, because it also uses a form of echolocation and sonar. And just one of the many fascinating things you learn in this book is that our flesh or our skin is sort of too soft to kind of reflect back, you know, the waves that they're putting out, but they can sense things like organs and bones. So a dolphin knows if there's a fetus in a pregnant woman and will treat that woman differently. And it's just, if you find that interesting, this book is absolutely jammed with facts like that. I thought it was an absolutely fascinating journey. If you have any interest at all in the animal world, the animal kingdom, and what's going on there, Ed Yong is your guide. And, you know, you can tell that he's just as curious and fascinated because he's a journalist too. And, you know, his whole, you know, when he wants to learn about a subject, he just dives in and tries to learn more and more. So he goes all over the world and interviews scientists and naturalists and explorers. It's kind of a cornucopia of fascinating facts about animal life and the world around us. And I just, to me, it was like a huge, like plastic, a huge, like pillowcase full of candy at Halloween or something. I mean, it was just, I just kept popping it and it was fascinating. So that's the first book I really want to recommend for anybody who enjoys reading, you know, popular science books or is an animal lover. So that's my first one.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say compendium, which is like your favorite word, you know, like so a compendium of facts about it. No, I mean, that's like, that's so right up the middle for John F. Lovell, you know, but I mean, listen, you know, like, you know, when you're describing it, all these like fascinating tidbits about different animals and stuff. And I was laughing because you're like, you know, you tell this crazy nugget about a dolphin being able to tell a woman's pregnant before she does. And you're like, you know, if you find that interesting, I don't know who wouldn't find that interesting, you know, like, yeah. but I'm sure there are people who wouldn't, but like, that's bananas, you know, and to think of like a big, you know, sort of well-written and heavily researched book filled with information like that, you know, I can't imagine that, then that wouldn't be worth the time to kind of pour through that. That's just like, you know, and it would be like the kind of book that really changes your perspective on literally just like going out the door and walking around, you know? So that's like your favorite kind of book, John, you know, the one that changes the way you look at the world, you know?
Yeah, I think early on in this podcast, one of the first episodes, I talked about a book called The Hidden Life of Trees. And it was very similar. It was talking about what's going on among and between trees and how they communicate and how they live. And it just opened up this entirely new world. And I remember us saying on that show, like, or I was saying, like, you will not walk through the woods and have the same experience again after reading that book. And this book is like that. It just, like you just said, it just makes you look around and just see everything in a different light. And I love books like that. It just open up whole new worlds on this planet. You know, it reads like science fiction, but it's not. It's happening all around us right here. So I love that stuff.
Well, that's awesome. So let's take a quick break, and then we'll probably be right back. I don't know if it's going to be just like 1 second, but, you know, we're winging it here.
Okay, sounds good.
All right.
Okay, Jude.
All right.
I'm going to hand it back.
Sorry, go.
What do you have next?
I've watched that. All right. So John, it's the, I think you're ready for this. This one is like kind of a more of a joint choice. There's a book that I discovered this year.
Hold on. I think this is going to make actually a nice segue.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah. In a way it is. Yeah. You're on the right track. So yeah, segueing off of John's last choice, where he talked about an immense world. There is a book that I discovered this year just completely by accident. So here's what happened. I just kind of stumble on it. Turns out to be the debut novel of like kind of an ex-scientist also. But he decided to turn his animal knowledge into kind of a, I would really describe this, you know, the name that I can't help but mention is like a Michael Crichton-esque kind of thriller.
No question.
Yeah, I discovered it by accident. Now, if you know, Michael Crichton, if you're a fan of his work from like the 80s and stuff, his books were kind of like sort of page turner airport, kind of cheesy thrillers, but they were very fun and very filled with, you know, often scientific or kind of, you know, quasi scientific or medical information. And that guy had a real skill. He's deceased, but a real skill in turning that into kind of like a ripping page turning thriller. This book is a lot like that, although I would argue that it's a little more sophisticated. Has to do with animal consciousness, but around a particular kind of animal, which is the octopus. This book that I'm talking about is called, and we'll talk about the title a little, like, it's called The Mountain in the Sea, and it's written by this guy named Ray Naylor, and it's a debut novel. And John, I'm going to ask you to kind of do this with me, because I read it several months ago and have forgotten a lot of the details, but basically it's about this scientist. He stepped in at any time, because I'm not going to have an easy time remembering this, but there's a discovery is made of a, is it a certain breed of octopus, or like, you know, or just like a community of octopi that are living like off this island that's near, I think it's Thailand. Do I have that right?
Yeah, okay. Thailand or Vietnam area. I think it's off of Vietnam, actually.
Yeah, actually, so this is going to be sort of a joint discussion. John, you've read it much more recently. Can you take a shot at describing the plot of this book?
Yeah, so, sure. So, yeah, a discovery is made. There's an opening chapter where a wrecked Thai freighter is being explored, and there are these scientists who are kind of exploring, and they get attacked while they're exploring, and one of them gets killed. And you're not really sure what it is, but something inside the wreckage attacked. It has this kind of cinematic, again, like Jurassic Park or something, has a cinematic opening. But you come to find out, and this is science fiction in kind of its best form, because it seems to be set sometime in the future. The political alignment of the world is a little bit different. There's an island off of the coast of, I believe it's Vietnam, that has, you know, had been kind of a nature preserve and sanctuary, but it has recently been bought by a biotechnology company. And you know it's sort of in a different world than ours, not only because of what I just said, but there's it's very memorable. It kind of describes what's going on this island. And there's sort of a Buddhist monastery on the island, but it's populated entirely by auto monks. They're like basically robotic monks who are.
Yeah, like droids.
Yeah. Who are continuing the functions of this Buddhist temple, but are not human. So that, you know, there are cues like that, that you're kind of living in the, you're existing in this sort of alternate, well, alternate future. You can't really say that because no one knows what the future is, but it's this rich sort of very intriguing imagining of what the future might be like. But there's a scientist who's called to the island, and she eventually, but she's, you know, like, as is typical in these kind of stories, she knows very little about why she's going. It turns out that there are, there's a group of octopuses that seem to have unusual, not powers, but abilities. And this particular scientist is, you know, that's been her area of study, animal consciousness, and how, and it's particularly in octopuses. And it kind of gradually, but there's like heavy security around the island as well. And there's another android figure that's doing science in the same place, and they sort of team up, and you learn more about that character and how they're a more advanced, you know, AI and android than has ever existed before. And that character itself is sort of a threat to the existing world, but there's kind of this, you know, alliance between this human scientist and this android, you know, artificial intelligence. They're trying to figure out the mystery of these octopuses, and more specifically, whether they have, there are hints that they may have language or some kind of way to communicate with other species. And so as the book unfolds, a kind of communication begins between the octopuses and the humans. And you kind of gradually realize that the octopuses are much more aware of what's going on in our world than has been previously thought. And in the meantime, there's other stuff going on in the world, and the island is under threat. And, you know, it kind of builds this sort of like climax where the island is sort of invaded. And I'll leave it there. I'm not going to say who it was invaded by or what, but it's kind of this like ingenious sort of sci-fi thriller that also really gets deep into the nature of animal consciousness. And again, like we were just talking about with Ed Yong's book, you know, how much do these animals know? How much are they aware of? Do they have the ability to communicate at all? And then the next question that follows from that, and this is talked about a lot in both books, if they can communicate, do they have culture of their own?
And yeah. So
this is a fiction, a kind of a cracking fiction thriller that looks at a lot of the same questions that Ed Yong does, but in the wrappings of a page turner.
Right. And that's the reason I'm bringing it up. Because this was one of the funner books I read this entire year easily. Cause like, I just kind of blew through this book, cause I was really impressed with the way writer who had formerly worked for, it's like the NOIA or something like that. Some kind of oceanic scientific government, you know, outfit, sort of combined in this book. I really loved it because it was like cutting edge science about octopuses in particular, which are fascinating animals to begin with.
Yes.
In an earlier episode, I remember talking about the book called The Soul of the Octopus, the nonfiction book that you read, right. You know, which was loaded with all that fascinating information about octopuses, because as John pointed out, it's octopuses, not octopi. Do I have that right?
You do have that right. That's a common myth.
Yeah. So anyway, this particular book called The Mountain and the Sea combines those elements, the fascinating science of the animal world, octopuses in particular, the ripping, you know, page turner qualities of Michael Crichton book. And then there's a ripple of kind of like AI. You don't always know who the humans are and who aren't the humans. A little futuristic aspect. There's also a subplot having to do with one of these like pirate ships that roams around in those waters and has these like people that are basically enslaved on the ships who are trying to recover things out of the sea. All these things are in there. And then you throw in that fascinating science fiction movie called Arrival. You remember that movie, John?
I do. Yep.
I don't know who's seen that movie, but there's like an element of aliens communicating with humans in that movie that was unlike, and that was based on a short story by what's the name of that Asian American fiction writer, John?
Ted Chiang.
Ed Chiang, thank you. Based on a short story by him, it bears comparison to that movie in some ways, especially when the octopuses try to communicate or begin to communicate. But the book is just ingeniously plotted. It has these like fascinating, you know, little sections to it. Every time you get to the end of the one of the sections, there's like a deeper layer that's like unveiled, and it's like more fascinating than the one before. There's like one scene where they find like the inner sort of lair of the octopuses, and it has this kind of weird like altar with all these human skulls.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You just have no idea what's going to come next. And that's why I wanted to talk about this book. Don't have to get into like all the details of the plot, but all these elements, it was just a ripping fun read. And if you have any interest in the animal world, sci-fi or futuristic tales, you cannot miss The Mountain and the Sea by Ray Naylor. To me, it's like a surefire winner as a debut novel. We'll see where the guy goes from here. Although you and I were joking because neither one of us really has any idea why the book is called The Mountain in the Sea. Do you have any theories on that, Sean?
Well, before I attack that, we said this is going to be loose, but I just came up with a great idea for the show that we're going to have to do, because I was reminded of, you know, we both took in this book fairly recently, and I'm like, this is going to be like Siskel and Ebert, you know, you give your opinion and you don't know what I'm going to say, and I'm going to go, well, you know, you're completely wrong on just about everything you just said, and I'll tell you why, you know, but it would be so fun to do like a Siskel and Ebert style episode where we pick like three books that we vehemently disagree on and just tear each other to shreds.
Well, oh yeah.
I mean, we have to do that as a,
yeah, that's a fun idea.
Yeah. But anyway, unfortunately we're not going to get into a classic Siskel and Ebert argument on this one, because this is like one of their reviews where they both just, sing the same song of praise. I loved this book. You picked it for me. I had never heard of it. For all the reasons you described, when I read the description, I thought, this sounds like it's going to be a lot of fun. And it is a lot of fun. But what really surprised me was the science in the book. And I am not a scientist. I'm not an expert by any stretch. But I was telling you this before.
But your dad was.
But my dad was. And your dad was. though not a biologist. But,
no.
You know, some of that scientific fascination is in there. Let's say that. It's weird. I was saying to you how weird it is that just in the past year, listen, I've read, or year, year and a half, I read The Soul of an Octopus by Cy Montgomery, which is, you know, cited in the back of Ray Naylor's book. It's definitely an influence on this book. Mm-hmm. I talked about the Ed Yong book. I read a long book called The Outlaw Ocean, which is about a lot about piracy and, you know, illegal fishing and human trafficking and slavery on the high seas. There's a couple other books that are escaping me that I've read recently, but they, you know, you mentioned the movie Arrival. There's so much that I recognize that kind of go into the mix of this book. But, I've been reading in the last year or so a lot about, you know, AI, human intelligence, human consciousness. There's a particular book that I almost brought up before by Megan O'Giblin, the essayist and journalist who wrote a fascinating book about artificial intelligence and human consciousness and religious faith. So I've read so much that all seem to be a part of the mix of this book. And so, like, I was impressed by the sophistication of the ideas. And, you know, I think he writes very, very credibly and intelligently, not just about octopus as an animal consciousness, but about AI. I thought the stuff about, you know, human trafficking and illegal fishing on the high seas, particularly around in that region of the world, Thailand, Vietnam, Indonesia, was right on point with what I had read in that great book by Ian Urbina. And there's even one of the sections of Ray Naylor's book is called Umwelt, which is the concept I just brought up from the Ed Yong book. So,
yeah,
you know, it's not just that this is that rare combination of it's totally like Jurassic Park or Sphere. It's a cracking science fiction book that just keeps you turning the pages. you're right. It's a lot like Arrival in kind of the plot, the bones of the plot, in terms of the two species starting to communicate with each other, which is a fascinating premise right there, because you just don't know where it's going to go. But it's also, it seems to me like the science is sophisticated behind it as well. So you're learning from the book as well as just kind of turning pages. This is just that rare combination of a really fun book that's also really interesting. It's a great, great pick. And I, you know, if any of this appeals to anybody who's listening, like you just said, you got to go out and read this book. It's a heavy recommendation from both of us.
Yeah, like when it comes out in paperback for like $14, that is, you know, that's going to be some of the best $14 you ever spent.
Yeah, I mean, so many people enjoyed like Sphere or Jurassic Park. And if you're one of those people, there's almost no way you're not going to enjoy this book. But it also incorporates a lot more contemporary and emergent technology that, you know, this is the age of ChatGPT and artificial intelligence and all that. It just fits right in there with all that stuff too, and all the debate that's going on literally right now to the day about this stuff. So it's really, this is a great one. I'm glad we got a chance to discuss it.
Yeah. Well, what do you got?
It's weird. We've touched on science fiction, you know, quite a bit on this episode, and that was not planned. In fact, we had talked about doing a separate science fiction episode, which we never did. So we may still do that, but I've got another book that is a science fiction book that I wanted to recommend. And this book is a book that's in translation. It's written by a Danish novelist I had never heard of named Olga Raven. And again, it's another book that we both read. It's the reverse. I read this one and said, dude, you got to check this book out. This book is, it's unlike anything I've ever read before. And I can say that firmly. And again, I say that having already described that we're talking about 50 plus years of reading. But this is a really deeply weird, unsettling, but fascinating book. And it's called The Employees. And it's a book I'm going to call up by. It's hard to describe what goes on in this book, and it's hard to describe why it appealed to me so much. I'm going to do my best, but I decided I would read a little synopsis that I found online that will hopefully give, you know, a flavor of what this book is like. It's a book. It has a very unique and weird structure. It's a book that's about an expedition that went out to research and do scientific exploration of another planet that was discovered. The planet is simply called New Discovery. And there's a ship called the 6,000 ship that is sent out by this corporation. And it's basically populated with scientists and employees of the corporation. And the book's called The Employees. But it's also crucially populated by humanoid, you know, robots, androids. Mm-hmm. And the mission of the ship is to go out and explore this planet, basically, and learn what we can. That's a setup for what I'm going to read. So from this article, it says, set aboard the 6,000 ship, the employees is relayed through a series of numbered statements, each dictated in turn to an unseen committee by anonymous employees of the ship. The committee's purpose, according to the preface at the beginning of the novel, is to, quote, gain knowledge of local workflows and to investigate possible impacts of the objects, as well as the ways those impacts, or perhaps relationships, might give rise to permanent deviations in the individual employee. Really, the whole book, especially when you start reading it, it's so opaque and oblique, you're just like, I don't even know what I'm reading. But part of the mastery of the book is that you kind of gradually discover what the book is getting at, even though it's so unusual and so disorienting when you first start to read it. The objects in question, which have been recently recovered from the planet New Discovery, have elicited a variety of strange reactions from the employees charged with their care, reporting instances of uncontrollable attraction, repulsion, haunting dreams, and mounting disquiet. The human and humanoid employees begin to question their relationship to their work and their humanity, or lack thereof. While the workers express their interactions with these objects in startlingly evocative language, the bureaucratic mechanism seems only interested in quote, workflows and deviations of individual employees. An effective divide emerges between employees and employers, not between human and machine. So all I could, it's so hard to describe this book. It's just this weird amalgamation of like interplanetary exploration and like corporate, dark corporate satire, you know. It's sort of like, it's like The Office meets Solaris, is, you know, but you don't have the comedic aspect. It's satirical, but not in a funny way, you know. And something has happened on this ship, and you come to learn, well, I don't want to spoil it for anybody who's interested in reading it. Something's happened on the ship that's being investigated by this committee. So the whole book is this very, it's a very short book, and it's this brief series of statements that are made by random employees. And they don't tell you whether it's a human employee or a robotic employee. And oftentimes they're just giving you these impressions or describing dreams. You don't know why they're doing that, but you come to realize that they're being affected by the objects that were recovered on this planet. The objects themselves are never described. You don't know what they are, and you don't really know what they can do. But all you get is the testimony of individual employees who are only named by number. And so it's this very strange, like, science fiction tale, but also, you know, look at, you know, how dehumanizing, you know, working for a massive corporation can be. And it builds up to, you know, you find out something about what happened on the ship that is kind of a twist and sheds the whole book in sort of a different light. But it is a weird, dreamlike rumination on a lot of fascinating topics. And, you know, if you're the kind of person, if you've ever seen like a Tarkovsky science fiction movie like Solaris, that is kind of a litmus test. If you found a movie like that fascinating as I did, you'd probably love this book. If you find a movie like that, like what the hell is going on here and I'm falling asleep, this book probably isn't for you. But I thought it was just a really interesting kind of more experience really than novel that you read. And it just lingered in my mind for a long time after I read it. I know it's been a while for you since you read it and it's very opaque and strange. But do you have any memories of it or anything that you want to say about reading The Employees?
Well, I thought it was really – so it, as John said, it was like the reverse. Like, you know, he discovered the book and then sent me a copy of it like I did with The Mountain and the Sea the other way. And I thought it was really worth him doing that. Like, I totally understood why he did that because, you know, it's such a weird experience. And, like, you just did about as good a job as you can – I'm trying to describe what this book is. But I would also say, like, it's a, you know, I read it after you, but it's the kind of book that it's a very short book. And each page of the book or like, you know, each section of the book is like this little memo or like verbal memo from like a different person or employee on the ship. Some of them are like just one paragraph long and none of them are over like a page and a half, you know. So you kind of, the structure of the book is very unique. You're in all these different voices and nothing is explained to you ahead of time, like you were saying. So it takes you quite a while in a very short book to even figure out what the heck is going on. So it's a very unique experience, but the book is short enough and weird enough that it's kind of, you sort of blow right by it. And then like, it does linger in your mind in sort of like a abstract way, but like, you know, 2 days later, you can't remember a single, you know, name or plot development. But what it was really worthwhile because it's so like your description of calling it like a combination between The Office and Solaris. If you know what Solaris is and you hear that description, if you don't think that's fascinating, then you're not going to, you know, you're out anyway. But like to put the Office and Solaris in a blender and see what comes out is just bananas, you know. And this book is very, you know, surreal, strange, or whatever, but it's a totally unique experience. And it's like kind of what I'm impressed with by it is it's like, you know, it is weird. It is unique. It is sort of like frustratingly opaque, like you're saying, but it has this like, this book has like a kind of a sinister quality. and like this, it's like a weird dream, like a weird nightmare that you kind of experience. And for me, as somebody, as you mentioned, who writes fiction and stuff like that, I have no idea how you would create that kind of atmosphere or come up with that kind of structure or achieve this all in such a small amount of pages, you know, with limited language. This is a book that's in translation, you know, but even though it's translated into English, you know, you're reading it and it's just like unsettling and weird. And I'm like, man, how did this person kind of like achieve this? And where would you possibly come up with the idea in the first place? You know, yeah. You know, like, so all those things about it to me are really impressive. It's like this totally bizarre experience. It's hard to remember individual plot lines, but it stands way out in your head somehow anyway. You're almost kind of like, like, did that happen? Or did I read that? Or what was that? You know, totally. And it just kind of throws you off for like, however, like the day and a half or 2 days that you're reading it. And that to me is really impressive. Like, you know, how it goes. Where the imagination comes from to do something like that, let alone just execute it to where you finish it and you're like, what the blank just happened? I don't even know what just happened.
Well, they don't, you know? The people.
Yeah. And like, and
either. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's so cool from that sense. You know, I guess there's a lot of people who wouldn't, you know, I'm thinking about people like your wife and other people that we know who are going to be like, you know, if you're going to go through even a day and a half of reading and you have no idea what you just experienced, you know, I'm not doing that, you know?
Right.
But from the fiction craft and just kind of mystery point of view, you know, you can't get a more mysterious book than this. You know, if you like anything that's like vaguely weird or unsettling, you're going to love a book like this.
That's right. And if nothing else, it's an incredible exercise in minimalism. I mean, it's like,
yeah,
like 120 pages, as you said, no chapter. And it's a small paperback. It's like 4 by 6 inches. No chapters more than a page and a half, you know. But and I don't pretend that I can even remotely understand everything that's happening in this book. But you do by the end, you realize that it is a kind of meditation about what it means to be human, you know, and sort of the limitations there. But you know, humans in community, because you know at some point, there's something violent that happens on the ship, which is inevitable whenever you have, you know, a bunch of humans together in a closed space. But because of this element, kind of similar to Sphere, where an alien object is brought on board and starts to mess with the psyche of the people who are on the ship, because of that, you have a way to explore things like memory and childhood and, you know, all this fascinating sort of psychological material. So, you know, at the end of the day, like a lot of science fiction, it's really about us and, you know, the mystery of our own, you know, consciousness. But, man, it's just a really creative and interesting short novel, you know, that I really loved, you know, digging into and thinking about. So that's The Employees. I think you have one more, right?
I do, yeah. So I'll try to cover it quickly. I guess we're, you know, we didn't plan this, but there's some similar, at least broad themes between some of these selections, because my next book is all kinds of weird, like mashup of different styles and genres also. But I really wanted to bring this one up for any, you know, one who's listening who's like sort of a fan of the show. You might remember a ways back, one of our deep dives into one book was we took on the debut novel of a really young and interesting writer by the name of Daniel Hornsby. And he wrote this book called Via Negativa.
Oh, yeah.
Which John and I sort of unpacked for an entire episode. That was a novel about a priest kind of on the lam with a pistol. It was kind of running away from kind of some of the darkness in his past. And he had been kind of defrocked, I believe. And he was didn't have a place to live. And he was running away from something, but also running towards something that was unresolved in his life. And he was going to possibly do an act of violence with the pistol he was carrying. And it was this really fascinating sort of debut novel about a sort of a priest on the run that we were very impressed by because the writer was so young, but he had a lot of interesting things to say about sort of faith and belief And he also took on a lot of the major issues that were affecting the Roman Catholic Church, which we thought was a brave and kind of fraught endeavor that he handled pretty well in the context of like kind of an interesting contemporary novel.
That's right.
So
I remember that book was a top 10 book for me the year that I read it.
Very fascinating book.
Hugely enjoyed that book. I thought it showed great potential.
Yeah, and we sort of like, after we did a podcast on that, we kind of like connected with Dan Hornsby, the writer, on like social media, you know, Twitter, etc. I think he heard our podcast. He was sort of young enough, I guess, to be very thankful and kind of happy that we had reviewed his book. And I got into a little bit of an exchange with him. And anyway, long story short, because I was sort of semi-connected with him, don't know him real well or anything like that, I heard that he was coming out with a new novel. And the book isn't even published yet. It's coming out in July. And the book's called Sucker. And he sort of put out there in various social media sites that he had some galley copies of the book. And he said, if anybody's interested in reading it and, you know, maybe writing a review of it, you know, let me know. So I was just ending a relationship I had with a magazine called Silver Sage that I wrote for 4 years. Fortunately, they closed their shop up. But I did about roughly 45 articles for them covering, like, films and books and doing book reviews, etc. And so I messaged him. I said, you know, I don't have this gig yet anymore, but I'd like to try to, like, if you want to send me a copy, I'll read it. And, you know, I'll try to do a review, see if I can find a place to publish the review. And he said, sure. So that was very nice of Dan Hornsby. But I had no idea what I was getting into. And, and this new book he's coming out with, is another novel called Sucker, is, you know, wildly, and for the most part, wildly divergent from Via Negativa. I really had no idea what the book was about. It turns out to be covering totally different material, although he does have some. Go ahead.
No, I just said I love it.
Yeah, this book is nuts. You know, it's very hard to classify. So I'll try to explain it. Although it does have some of the same type of commentary, Rye commentary, believe it or not, on, if not faith and belief, kind of larger questions. And you'll see how that works in a minute when I try to describe this. I should have just brought the galley with me and read the description because it's kind of hard to encapsulate. But anyway, very different kind of book. Sucker is about this young man who is the son of a arch right wing conservative billionaire. And so he's like kind of an heir to a ton of money through this like really conservative billionaire, like a champion of Fox News kind of guy. But he is very notably not the oldest son. He's the second son. So he's not kind of like the lead guy. And he, early on in the book, he makes no bones of the fact that he's really trying to sort of disassociate himself from his entire bloodline and family. However, the money is good. So he uses a lot of, the money, the wealth that he grew up with, the generational wealth that he has to kind of get in places and whatever. And he kind of has he has qualms about it, but he doesn't hide the fact that he's kind of a, what they might call a nepo baby in today's times, you know. It opens doors for him that he's happy to walk through. So you find out quickly that this book is a very satirical sort of black comedy, but it goes into many weird places. So this guy ends up at Harvard, and then early in the book, he reconnects. He's a few years out from Harvard, and he has his own punk rock record label, because that's what you do when you have tons of money, when you don't know what to spend it on.
Sure.
And he's kind of running in it, it's semi-successful, and, you know, he moves in all these circles in the punk scene in California, happens to run into an old classmate of his from Harvard who is starting, like, a tech company, like a, you know, like a high-tech Silicon Valley-type company. And so it's really hard to describe, but basically this person has invented this implant that goes into a human body that has a special way of floating through the body and collecting data that for the moment when he first meets her, it has the is like an ingenious way of like gathering data and diagnosing diseases. But they haven't put this out publicly yet, but they've discovered a way in which they can further develop this technology somehow, which is explained in the book, to where you can use the data that it's collecting to, like, catch diseases in advance and therefore in some way extend the lifespan of a human individual, possibly past like 150 or 200 years, and who knows how much further they can extend it beyond that once they market and to further develop this implant that they've invented. Wow. So she asked him if he would come on as kind of a creative consultant to this company. And so having nothing better to do, and he knows that it'll really piss his dad off, he decides to kind of hook up with this technology company, and he has this job as like a quote-unquote consultant. Well, when he goes to work for this company, he's also trying to continue to run his punk rock label. And he has this like real ride and dry sense of humor. And he finds a way to take the death of a punk singer who signed to his label and exploit it for like profit and extend, you know, turn that into kind of a cash cow by the fact that this guy has disappeared and died violently. But he's also getting further sucked into this new company, which has the interesting and kind of wink, wink name of Kenosis, which I think, John, Kenosis is like a Gnostic concept or like a Greek term. Do you know what Kenosis means? I'm trying to remember.
The Greek term, yeah, but I can't recall. I mean, I could probably look it up here really quick. But
is that something to do with, like, you know, the truth or light or something like that? But anyway.
Just something like that.
Yeah. But anyway, the story is about this guy, you know, trying to disassociate himself from his wealthy family, running this punk rock label and then getting sucked into this technology company, which really turns out to be a cover for like this connection that the woman who founded the company has with this ancient tribe of vampires that have been around for like millennia and are trying to use her to get access to this technology so they can take over the world kind of thing. Sure. And he gets pulled into this whole like subplot with these weird ancient vampires. And it is just a totally insane book that goes in many different directions you would not expect, but it is very, very funny. I was amazed at how funny the book was. I know Dan Hornsby is a talented writer, but he just exploits all this stuff, like the arch conservative, the money, the capitalism, like the Fox News angle, the tech world. And then he throws into this book elements of like the show Severance or like the novel The Circle from that Dave Eggers wrote about the tech company. That was a far inferior novel, in my opinion.
Terrible.
And throws, I totally agree, but he throws in like vampires and the possibility of eternal life. And that's where he gets some of his commentary and lines in that are actually sort of in keeping with the book Via Negativa, fundamental questions about who we are, why we're here, how long should we be here, who's running the show. And I read this book and I was just totally baffled and impressed by how different and, you know, much of a zag it was from the novel Via Negativa. It's a totally different tone and vibe to it, but it's very inventive and very funny. I think you will really love the book, John. I think there were parts of it that were not successful. By the way, I do have a review that is coming out in the Jesuit magazine called America. That's the National Jesuit magazine. They're publishing my review, but it hasn't come out yet. The book comes out in July. It's called Sucker. And I don't know, John, where does that bizarre description kind of leave you?
Well, first of all, I looked up Kenosis, and I think it's important to touch on this. Are you hearing an echo at all?
I hear it sometimes. I'm not hearing it now.
Okay. It's a theological term, Christian theology. The renunciation of the divine nature, at least in part, by Christ in the incarnation. But then a separate definition I have here, it says, kenosis in Orthodox theology is the transcending or detaching of oneself from the world or the passions. So.
Okay, so I was dead on.
Yeah. But, you know, it's consistent with what we know about Dan Hornsby. He does have a background in theological studies, I believe. I believe he went to seminary.
Yeah, that's true. Good point. I didn't mention that.
Don't know if he finished, but I know he went. And, you know, he has, if you've read Via Negativa, you know that he has an interest in spiritual matters or spiritual questions. Look, man, this book sounds like just a blast from top to bottom to me. It's just like with everything you described, just kind of like a mishmash of all these different, you know, cultural touch points. But I don't say that like the book reads as a mishmash. He's a talented writer. As I said, I thought Via Negativa was a propulsive story that also was very moving. It really, and very human. It really touched on a lot of interesting and deep questions. When I got to the end of that book, I just thought this is all working for me. I know you had some quibbles about the ending, but there is a real lingering kind of effect of kind of poignancy and sadness and regret that I got that from that book that I found was pretty impressive in such a young writer. I'm sure you take this kind of wild setup, but Dan Hornsby be Dan Hornsby. I think there's likely more going on under the surface. And I bet you that certain questions linger after you finish, you know, taking that ride. So I'm really looking forward to reading it. I think it's great that we were able to kind of highlight a book that hasn't come out yet. And I hope people will seek it out, as well as your article, your review in America Magazine, which has a pretty significant, what's the word I'm looking for? Subscription rate.
Circulation?
Circulation. So it'll be available online, I'm sure. I hope people will seek that out at some point.
Yeah, it was cool that they took it from me and decided to publish it. That was cool. I like what you said there about Via Negativa, because it's just one of the things that's so impressive about the book to me is that Via Negativa did have, I had some quibbles with it, you're right, but it did have some degree of poignancy. Okay, poignant is not the word I would use at all for the book Sucker. So I'm just so impressed that he did a book with such a different shift in tone. I already pointed this out. The book is very funny. Like, I know it's trying to be funny. I was very skeptical that it would be funny. It is funny. At least, John, I think you will think it is. And then also, the other thing I was going to say is I'm not name dropping. I'm not friends with Dan Hornsby. You know, we're just social media acquaintances. That's all. But he did tell me that he's the novel he's writing now is set in the Middle Ages. So this is a guy who likes to change it up. I have no idea what that is or when that'll be around, but, you know, I'm impressed with the diversity of the stories that he can come up with in his very young career. But yeah, look for the book Sucker. I think it's a, you know, it may polarize some people, but I thought it was a hell of a lot of fun.
Well, it sure sounds like it. And Hornsby sounds like a BXC kind of guy, a book exchange kind of guy.
Yeah.
I think we're not friends just because we haven't had the fortune of meeting, but I bet we would be if we find ourselves in an airport lounge or on a desert island or something. So,
yeah, I think we'd get along.
Dan, if you ever hear this, you know, you're hereby invited to have a conversation on the show someday about one of your books or anything else. But, and that's not a shameless plug either. I just think he's been friendly with us and, you know, he just seems like not just a good guy, but he's definitely a talented writer. I'm really looking forward to reading that one.
Yeah, you're going to enjoy it.
All right, I'm going to touch on one more book here, and then we'll kind of move into the wrap-up part of the show. Pretend that I hadn't talked to you about this book previously, Jude, okay? So,
all right.
I'm going to say, Jude, did you know that at one point, at a point in history earlier than the Egyptian pyramids, there was a massive metropolis in the area that is now just east of St. Louis, Missouri, right here in the United States, that included a massive pyramid and a wide urban expanse on both sides of the Mississippi River called Cahokia. Did you know that?
Hell no. I did not know that.
How is it possible that there was and at the time, it was the largest metropolis that is known of in the Americas. And that's including, you know, some of the great urban centers of the Aztecs. But You didn't learn anything about that in no grade school or high school. I had no idea at all that that ever existed. Yet there are traces of it that are currently being explored on the east side of the city of St. Louis. Shout out to a good buddy of ours, Chris, who lives in St. Louis. I wonder if he knows. Well, that is just one of four lost cities that are explored in a fascinating book called Four Lost Cities by a journalist and writer named Anna Lee Newitz. The subtitle is A Secret History of the Urban Age. And what they prefer to go by the pronoun they. What they do in the book is explore four different ancient civilizations that have basically been lost to time and only been kind of, she makes this point very, they make this point, the pronoun thing is going to be tough for me. They make this point very clearly in the book in the beginning that, you know, we call them lost civilizations, but in reality, you know, the traces of these civilizations have been there all along and they haven't been lost at all. They were just covered by whatever, you know, either natural phenomena or, had been discovered earlier and literally just forgotten about. But this is a fascinating look at four vast urban empires, basically, that existed long ago. One is called, I'm going to butcher these sayings, but one is called Çatalhöyük in central Turkey. The second one is the city of Pompeii. Most of us know about it because of the volcanic, you know, disaster there. But that was a large and thriving city that has, there's much to be learned about it. It's fascinating. There's another one called Angkor in Cambodia. It's famous for the Angkor Wat temple, but that was actually a vast civilization that was there in an incredible urban center that was there that the jungle has basically taken over. But at the height of its, at the height of its civilization, it was an incredible and ornate place. And then finally, this massive city called Cahokia, that was right here in the middle of the United States. And what this book does is just kind of explores all four of these sites. And with a particular angle of trying to, you know, draw lessons from it for urban life now in terms of, because one of the reasons why most of these ancient civilizations have had failed, and it, you know, they're very different in what happened, but often it's environmental factors and human choices that go into that were made. And also, you know, basically class struggles between the rich and powerful and the poor. These kind of choices have an effect on whether or not these civilizations thrived or fell. And so the author is trying to draw whatever lessons and kind of inferences we can from that. Crap, I'm hearing an echo here. I don't know if you are.
No, I'm not hearing it. So just keep going. You know, we're winging it.
Yeah, we don't know what kind of, you know, what the audio quality is going to be like here. But anyway, it's just a fascinating book about these four different ancient civilizations that I knew nothing about. In the case of the one in Cambodia, there was an incredibly elaborate system, basically waterwork system of managing water and collecting water from the rainforest that enabled the civilization to thrive. But there's a fascinating look at how, you know, they engineered an enormous man-made lake and reservoir. They had an elaborate kind of tunnel system. You know, we learn as like grade school kids about like the aqueducts in Rome. This place had an unbelievably sophisticated, engineered system of bringing water from the jungle into the urban area, which was much, much larger than anything that was ever in Rome. It's just fascinating. And some of the decisions they made, for example, they go through a period of like 2 or 3 years of drought. And so they build much, much wider sort of channels and tunnels to bring water into the urban area. And then they went through about 10 years of like incredibly heavy monsoons and basically destroyed themselves, you know, because of the way, I mean, it was just, you know, so it's a fascinating combination, like I said, of human decision and also coupled with environmental factors. And there are obviously, you know, parallels between, you know, that kind of stuff and what's going on now with the environment and the choices we're making. It's not an overly sort of, it's not like an environmental screed at all, but it certainly acknowledges, you know, some of those parallels that I just described, but it's really just a fascinating exploration of these four ancient civilizations that I knew nothing about. And I was just gripped by the whole thing, in particular, the last section about this massive urban metropolis that was, you know, built by indigenous people here in, right here in, you know, what we call the American Midwest, people we know very little about. And so the effort to try to discover who they were, what their culture was like, you know, from the archaeological evidence is just fascinating. So, like, this is just an eye-opening book for me in a number of ways. And it's got kind of an Indiana Jones element to it. You know, it's like part Indiana Jones, you know, discovery and fascination, and part kind of like, what can we learn from, you know, the demise of these civilizations, and, you know, part like what urban planning, you know, what makes for a smart city, you know, how do we organize and engineer our cities so that they're, you know, accessible and beneficial for all, not just the rich. There's an element in this book. I think her approach is very deliberately, she or they tried to find out about, you know, who the everyday citizens in these places are, not just the people who own the villa or the palace, but the people who clean garbage and the people who work the fields and the people who cooked. What did they cook? How did they cook? And so there's a very kind of democratic feel to the book as well. I thought it was fascinating, and I thought the scholarship was impressive, and I thought it was very readable too. So, you know, for anybody who has an interest in ancient civilizations or that kind of thing, you can't really go wrong with this book called Four Lost Cities. It was really gripping.
So a couple things about that. So some of these nonfiction books that you're talking about and that you discover, you have to be impressed with just kind of the distance that these writers went to kind of like research and put together a kind of sort of a robust and kind of gripping narrative on these things. And I don't know how nonfiction writers like that, you know, gather so much information and sort of press it all into this coherent narrative that you can read easily. That's just impressive to me, you know, but,
totally agree.
But, you know, so, question, you might have said this, but like the last city you mentioned, the one that was in the St. Louis area, what years are we talking about when this would have been there?
Yeah, now you're testing my memory here.
Well, even like a ballpark.
I think like around 1000 AD, you know.
So okay.
Well before like Columbus and things like
yeah.
That.
Yeah. Okay. No, I was just curious. And then the other thing that sort of struck me was like, it's just interesting to hear about all these different places. Of course, didn't know about any of them except for Pompeii. And even though some of these cities, and you might not remember this, I just, you know, listening to you talk about it, even though some of these cities were sort of reacting to environmental events or like trends that helped contribute to why they didn't succeed, it seems to me that Pompeii still kind of stands out from the other three, though, because wasn't its whole demise not so much because, I don't know, maybe the book goes into it, it's not so much because of the choices they made and some of the class, friction or whatever, but because of this one disastrous event? Or is that popular myth that, I mean, I know the volcano eruption happened, but it seems to me like these three other ones, like they kind of failed for different reasons over what must have been a certain period of time and sort of like died out, whereas Pompeii was kind of just wiped out. Isn't that true? Or is there like other things that, does it go into like, are there more connections between Pompeii and the other three in terms of like the choices that the citizens made that led to them getting wiped out? I don't know.
No, it's a little bit of an outlier that there was this disastrous event. It did not completely destroy the city, by the way. But it kind of led to its eventual demise. And it was not, but the other thing is, it wasn't the only eruption that happened and affected that city. But it was obviously a major one and a, you know, catastrophic in many ways. But
Right.
That section of the book was really more about, because the story of the eruption is well known, it was really more about kind of the social atmosphere there. And like, you know, it was like a very sophisticated like shopping town. They basically had shopping malls there. They had like thriving like entertainment and kind of sex worker kind of industry there. And you know, describes a lot of like, there's all kinds of graffiti in the city that reflects a lot of different aspects of that society. So it was kind of more of a deeper dive into what life and society was like in Pompeii. This place that everybody knows about, but only because of the eruption. So in that case, it wasn't this kind of gradual decline, but the eruption wasn't the only factor either. So,
interesting.
Yeah, it was fascinating. Yep. Like I didn't. There's so much like pornographic graffiti in Pompeii that if you go and visit it, like with your family, I mean, you know, you're not going to avoid any of that stuff. So it's kind of interesting.
I mean, now or at the time?
Well, the now, but that still exists from the Roman times. They just like, you know, there are phalluses and penises everywhere. And they're just
awesome.
Like, not just on the wall, but like statues and stuff. And, you know, it's just an interesting look at, you know, maybe what that society valued, you know?
Right.
Awesome. But anyway, you know, we've been going on for a long time. I'm going to cut this off there, and I think we'll quickly kind of cover the last stuff.
That's not new.
Yeah, that's not new. But it's been fun. I'm glad we got this thing going again. Let's just briefly cover, you know, what do you got coming up on deck? What are you going to read next?
Okay. Well, I can cover that for you. I haven't actually announced this to you, John. So this is, well, I think you know that I own it, but it's not, you know, I didn't tell you it was officially on my on-deck circle. But what's coming up next for me, it's going to be fun. Also, another deep dive we did on this podcast way back towards the beginning was a book called They're There, which was written by a Native American writer named Tommy Orange.
Yeah.
I'm reading a book not by Tommy Orange, but I'm only bringing that up because the book I'm reading has to do with a Native American populace, but it's a very different one from what's covered in They're There. They're There was a debut novel about a Native American community in California. What I'm going to read next is a very buzzy and very much honored debut collection of short stories that goes by the name of Night of the Living Rez, R-E-Z, and it's written by somebody by the name of Morgan Talty. Debut book. It just won a big award. I can't remember what award that was, but it's been quite acclaimed. It's a book of short stories that centers around, I'm not going to get this right, it's something, the Native American tribe that is the centerpiece of this particular collection of stories is called like Penobscot or something of that nature. I don't wish to butcher it. I just can't remember exactly how to say it. But it's a tribe of Native Americans that centers around like New England, northern New England and Maine. This is a book of stories that's set in that particular region, contemporary as far as I understand. And I brought up Tommy Orange because you picked the book up and it's got the first thing you see is like a blurb from Tommy Orange, you know, like because that's the way the publishing industry works, about how great the book is. But this book has been sort of like universally lauded, kind of like Tommy Orange's book. It's supposed to be a really, really good collection of stories from a very promising new young writer. I don't know, but I'm going to read that collection of stories next and I'll get back to you. But that's where I'm going. The book is called Night of the Living Rez. And it's by Morgan Talty. So,
hey, Jude, I think we got cut off there for a minute, but we're back now. You were just talking about Morgan Talty's Night of the Living Rez. I remember, I don't know if you remember, but actually on the last episode that we did produce back in July of 2022, we were talking about books we were looking forward to for the rest of the year. And you did talk about that book briefly. And I also, looking back at it, I realized I talked about Ed Yong's book, Immense World. So we're both kind of doubling back to books that we had talked about last year on the show. So that's pretty cool.
Oh, wow.
But yeah, that sounds like a really good book. I'm sure it's going to be fascinating. And you're going to be, yeah, I didn't tell you this either, but you're going to be super excited to hear what I have coming up next, because it's a book that you gave to me a while back, and I just haven't gotten around to it. But I'm looking forward to diving into it now. When I finish this book about R.S. Thomas, I'm going to be diving into the big book of the Continental Op by Dashiell Hammett. Do you remember?
Oh, wild. Yeah.
Do you remember giving me that book?
Yeah, that is sweet. Yeah, I can't wait to hear what that's like.
Yeah, it's going to be a real curveball. I'm super excited about it. And for those who don't know, you know, Dashiell Hammett is one of the most well-known and popular kind of writers of crime and detective fiction in the last century, the 20th century. And he was working in like the 30s and 40s and 20s. But he wrote a long series of detective stories that featured a character known only as the Continental Op. He's an operative that works for the Continental Detective Agency. You never learn his name. And there's a whole series of detective stories that he wrote that feature him that were published in various detective and crime magazines in, I believe, the 20s and 30s. And he became a really popular character, and somebody had the genius idea to collect them all. And so it's like, you know, Dashiell Hammett, well known for novels such as The Maltese Falcon, The Dane Curse, The Glass Key, Red Harvest. You know, many Hollywood movies have been based on stories of his. Famously, of course, The Maltese Falcon, but there are many others. But somebody had the genius idea to collect all these into a compendium, to use that term that you mentioned before.
There you go.
And I'm really just looking forward to it. I think he's got a really kind of cracking way of writing these detective stories, hilarious dialogue. And you and I are big fans of the filmmaker Rian Johnson. And I know Rian Johnson has cited the Continental Op and those stories as being the primary inspiration for his debut film Brick, which is excellent. And which he kind of, you know, puts a noir detective story and kind of plants it into a modern high school. And he uses some of the same type of dialogue that like a Dashiell Hammett would use. So that's a great movie. I'm really looking forward to reading those stories. I've read a few of the Dashiell Hammett novels that are really, they're just gripping fun detective stories. But these kind of shorter stories, I think, are going to be a hell of a lot of fun. And it's a big, thick book of them. So that should be rewarding. So that's what I'm doing next.
Yeah, that's a wicked curveball. I like that a lot. Yeah, I remember that just came up in my head not too long ago for some reason or another. I remember. So it's cool that that's – yeah, it was a while ago that I gave you that, but that happens. So
it's not – for some reason or another, we know the reason. At this point in our lives, it's the hive mind. I mean, it's because I was thinking about it recently that it just popped up into your mind. I mean
– yeah.
I'm joking, but I'm like – 60% sure that is the reason that it popped up in your mind, which is really weird. But
oh yeah, I was talking with my son Patrick, who's like great friends with your son Sam.
That's
you
right.
know,
that's right.
I'm and right. There's like a yeah, thank. There's a different. There's a gap in age between them. You know, my son happens to be he's going on 15, and your son is just about to be 18. And, you know, that would normally prohibit something like that, but I swear that has something to do with their DNA. They're just like, you know, the fact that they come from the two of us, they're just kind of like simpatico somehow. Oh, and they just get on, you know?
Yeah, they're fast friends. And, but I, you know, that's a whole other subject for another show. But, you know, the fact that I was thinking in the last week or two, I kind of was looking at my books and decided to pick that book. It wouldn't surprise me at all if that had at least something to do with why the book swam into your mind, which is really weird. Now we're getting into like octopus consciousness weird. Kind of.
Yep. Yeah. I'd like that, you know, that sort of twin voodoo that, you know, if we went too far into it, we'd sort of blow the minds of all of our millions of listeners. So we don't want to, you know, we don't want to go too hard too soon here.
Yeah.
Just getting back into the game.
Well, we've already bludgeoned their mind with all this book talks and you know, blathering on and on. So we're going to wrap this up. Very quickly, we have plans for episode 54. Not sure when we're going to record it, but and this also kind of connects back to that episode 52 where we were anticipating books that were coming out later in the year. You know, we highlighted the most the books we were most excited about by far were a pair of books that were being released by Cormac McCarthy, the great American novelist. The first books that he had published in 16 years, pair of novels called The Passenger and Stella Maris. And, you know, that was kind of the consensus number one in terms of books we were most excited about. Well, in the meantime, after, you know, we had that long hiatus, both of us have read these novels. We wanted to dedicate an episode to Cormac McCarthy and these novels in particular. So I think that's going to be our next episode, episode 54. We will cover The Passenger and Stella Maris by Mr. Cormac McCarthy. And that's what's coming up.
Yeah, and if you want to get technical, Cormac McCarthy goes all the way back to episode one, where we talked about the books that made us fiction. And I know I brought up his novel Blood Meridian as one of the books that made me.
That's right.
So, you know, he's a writer we've been talking about off and on the whole way, but we've never demonstrated. We talked often about doing a dealer's choice about his work, but it sort of, I don't know, sort of seemed like an obvious thing to do. But with the publication of these two books after 16 years, we knew if we ever got it back that we would do an episode on those books. So.
That's right. So that's coming. That's coming down the pike. But we want to just say thank you for those who have reconnected with the show or have joined us for the first time. Thank you for listening to the Book Exchange podcast. It's been really fun to get it going again. We hope we can cobble this recording together and get it out there. And we hope that you will spread the word and keep listening to the show. That's about it, Jude. Enjoy the rest of your weekend, and we will talk to you all later.
Yep. Thank you for joining. We're back like that hand out of the grave. Thanks for listening, John. Have a good rest of the weekend.
All right. You too, man. Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.